We are continuing this afternoon our studies in the book of Esther, a book which is a very wonderful book because it speaks of the providence of God with regard to his ancient people, the Jews. Let me remind you again of the context. It may be that not all of you were here for the first two occasions when we looked at this wonderful book. The date at the beginning of the book is roughly 484 BC. That's 484 years before the coming of Christ. Now that date lies in between the two returns of the Jews from captivity. You remember that the first return from captivity had occurred in 538 BC. That is to say, the Jews that had been taken captive by Nebuchadnezzar were returned, according to the promise of God, into their own land. There was the exile, then there was the restoration, and in 538 BC, some 50,000 Jews, returned to the land of Israel. It was a very, very wonderful event. But there was a second return, some 80 years later, namely in 458 BC. A smaller return, a return of some 6,000 to 7,500 people, and this was under Ezra. The first return then, in 538 BC, some 50,000 under Zerubbabel. The second return in 458 BC, under Ezra, when some 6,000 to 7,000 return. Now, the events of the book of Esther lie in between these two returns. And the events of the book of Esther then relate primarily to those Jews that had not returned, those Jews that remained in exile. And of course, there were many that never returned. And we're dealing here with Jews that are living in the land of Persia under Ahasuerus, or as he is also known, Xerxes. Now, this is a heathen king, and this is a heathen land, and these are heathen practices. And we need to remember that as we consider these things, namely that we see the hand of God working wonderfully in the lives and watching over his people as they live on in exile, as they continue there, not so much in captivity as living with the remnants and the relics of captivity, not in their own land. And we see an attempt by this wicked man, Haman the Agagite. Remember, the Agagite was an Amalekite, and there was this mortal enmity in his blood towards the Jews. So that when Mordecai, the cousin of Esther, refuses later to bow down to Haman, this kindles this wicked man Haman's wrath. So much so that he not only wants to destroy Mordecai the Jew, but the entirety of the Jewish race. So what Haman plots here is genocide, nothing short of genocide. He wants to exterminate the entire Jewish race. Now this doubtless would have extended not only to the Jews that lived in the area in question, but throughout the Middle East. So that potentially the entire Jewish race would have been exterminated by the decree that Ahasuerus unwittingly and foolishly had given in response to this wicked man Haman in his enmity and hatred of Mordecai the Jew. So then the date here approximately is now roughly 484, perhaps 480 BC. It's possible that a number of years have elapsed between the events of chapter 1 and the events of chapter 2. And we're going to trace now the developments within the kingdom. Remember, this is the Persian kingdom. That is the second kingdom of the four kingdoms mentioned by Daniel in his prophecy. Daniel chapter 2, it's also repeated in Daniel chapter 7. Daniel sets forth as part of the prophecy of God that Gentile world dominion would prevail for the next 600 years up until the coming of Christ. And there will be four great kingdoms. The four great kingdoms are pictured by the head of gold. Nebuchadnezzar the Babylonian is this head of gold. So the kingdom of Babylon, that mighty, powerful kingdom that had been responsible for taking the Jews into captivity in the first place, three deportations, the main one being in 586 BC, Nebuchadnezzar is that head of gold. The Babylonian kingdom is the head of gold. The second kingdom is the kingdom of the Medes and the Persians. We're now in that here. In other words, Ahasuerus belongs to that second kingdom. The date is coming down, moving towards the coming of Christ. The third kingdom would be the kingdom of Greece. The fourth kingdom would be the kingdom of Rome. And we know, of course, that it was in the days of Caesar Augustus that a decree went forth that all the world should be taxed. And as a result, Mary and Joseph went up from Nazareth, where they lived, to Bethlehem, the city of his fathers, so that he could be enrolled in a census for the purpose of taxation. Now, that's the historical background. It's my view that it's very valuable, very important to know the historical background. It's not exactly clear from the texts themselves where these things are, what the date is, what the order of these events is. That's where the plethora of good, fine books becomes valuable, and we can piece these things together like a jigsaw and locate precisely the time of these things. So, the date is 484 to 480 BC. Vashti has already been deposed. She refused to appear before the king and before all those that were invited for the guests. Almost certainly some lewd, lascivious practice was in view. It may well be that that was in view. It may well be, therefore, that her refusal to come was perfectly valid and proper. But as a result, she is deposed as queen. She is effectively divorced as his wife. It's a very good example of the cruelty and the wickedness that men display in their marriages and in their treatment of spouses. Men against women. Yes, and women against men, the way in which they put asunder that which God has joined together. So Vashti is now out of the picture, and the king is now concerned to find a replacement for her. We know, of course, that that replacement is Esther, and this chapter deals with that. And it's because Esther is in place as the queen that Haman's soon-to-arise dispute with Mordecai and the attempted genocide with regard to the Jews is thwarted, precisely because Mordecai's cousin is Esther. So then, let's have a look at the opening verses of chapter 2. After these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus was appeased, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what was decreed against her. Then said the king's servants that ministered unto him, let there be fair virgins sought for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather together all the fair young virgins unto Shushan the palace, to the house of the women, under the custody of Hagar, the king's chamberlain, keeper of the women, and let their things for purification be given them. And let the maiden which pleaseth the king be queen instead of Vashti, and the thing pleased the king, and he did so. Now notice then the appeasing of the wrath of King Ahasuerus. Now what I'm about to say is not exactly the meaning of the text in verse 1, but it is a kind of application of the text in verse 1. Notice this concept of appeasing the wrath. It reminds me of the way in which God's wrath has been appeased through the sacrifice of Christ. It is very, very important that we understand the doctrine of the atonement. And the doctrine of the atonement, quite simply, is this, that the wrath of God against man's sin is such that it burns in holiness and in judgment and needs, therefore, to be appeased, placated, and averted. And that's precisely what the death of Christ has done. The wrath of God has been averted because that wrath has been appeased and placated because God sent forth his Son as a sacrifice for sins and a substitute for sinner. Christ had to die if the wrath of God was to be appeased. And that is the wonderful effect of the death of Christ. Now, men hate this doctrine. There are professing Christians that hate this doctrine. It is a liberal opposition to the things of God that is manifested here. A kind of anti-supernaturalistic bias against the things of God. But that is the doctrine of the atonement, that the wrath of God towards man and man's sin has been averted because it has been placated and has been appeased by the sacrifice of Christ himself. That's why John the Baptist cried, "Behold the Lamb of God, which taketh away the sin of the world." Christ, remember, is the scapegoat who suffers in the place of the sinner, and is typified by the scapegoat that is released on the Day of Atonement there in the book of Leviticus. I mention that because there's an interesting picture in a sense of this. We have here the wrath of King Ahasuerus appeased. Far more wonderful, though, far more wonderful is the appeasing of the wrath of God, a righteous wrath. The wrath of Ahasuerus may well have been an unrighteous wrath, but this is a righteous wrath that has been appeased and placated by the death of God's Son. So then, a replacement is to be sought. And that's what all these preparations involve. You find that the invitation goes out to gather all the fair young virgins under Shushan. Basically, the king's harem is being filled here. And amongst them is Esther. She also has the name. It's here a little later. Hadassah. She's also known as Esther. And it's in that context and in that way that Esther is brought into the situation. Now, this is a critical event, because you may remember that later on, Mordecai says to her that it may well be that she's come to the kingdom for such a time as this. Those words there in chapter 4 and verse 14. "And who knoweth whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this." There's a sense there in that verse that I've just cited of God's providence. Now, the hand of God's providence is powerfully present in this book. I remind you, you may or may not know this, I remind you that the name of God does not occur once in the book of Esther. In that sense, it's quite unique. In that sense, it's quite extraordinary. The name of God is absent, but the hand of God is powerfully, powerfully present. The hand of God and the finger of God, as we shall see. There are some very wonderful providences in this book, some very wonderful ironies in this book. God's timing is remarkable. Esther is brought into position here as a result of Ahasuerus's conduct, Vashti's conduct, Ahasuerus's conduct. So Esther is now in position to become the queen instead of Vashti. A replacement has been sought, and she before long is selected. Verse 5. "Now in Shushan, the palace, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captivity, which had been carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. And he brought up Hadassah," that is Esther, "his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother, and the maid was fair and beautiful, whom Mordecai, when her father and mother were dead, took for his own daughter." Now it's evident, therefore, that Mordecai and Esther were cousins. He probably was the older cousin, may well have been quite a little bit older. He's almost like an uncle. We certainly could call him a kind of foster parent. And he brings her up. So Esther and Mordecai are inextricably linked in this wonderful story, and the connection between them is very, very important. I want to paint in a little bit of the background to this. Turn, please, to 2 Kings chapter 24. 2 Kings chapter 24. And verse 6. In 2 Kings chapter 24 and verse 6, we have a reference to Jehoiakim. Jehoiakim is mentioned in 2 Kings chapter 24 and verse 6. But you notice that back in the book of Esther, the name in chapter 2, verse 6 is Jeconiah. They are the same person. They are the same king. Jehoiakim and Jeconiah are the same king. And the reference here in chapter 24 of Kings, 2 Kings 24 and verse 6, is to the events that involve the taking into captivity of Mordecai's ancestors. So the situation is this: Mordecai is there in Persia. How did he get there? He got there, of course, because of the deportations. And we're going to read about it just briefly. So 2 Kings 24, verse 6. Jehoiakim, that's the same as Jeconiah, Jehoiakim was 18 years old when he began to reign. And he reigned in Jerusalem 3 months. And his mother's name was Nehushta, the daughter of Elnathan of Jerusalem. And he did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord, according to all that his father had done. At that time, the servants of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came up against Jerusalem, and the city was besieged. And Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came against the city, and his servants did besiege it. And Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, went out to the king of Babylon, he and his mother, and his servants, and his princes, and his officers. And the king of Babylon took him in the 8th year of his reign. And he carried out thence all the treasures of the house of the Lord, and the treasures of the king's house, and cut in pieces all the vessels of gold which Solomon, king of Israel, had made in the temple of the Lord, as the Lord had said. And he carried away all Jerusalem, and all the princes, and all the mighty men of valor, even 10,000 captives, and all the craftsmen and smiths. None remained, save the poorest sort of the people of the land. And he carried away Jehoiakim to Babylon, and the king's mother, and the king's wives, and his officers, and the mighty of the land. Those carried he unto captivity from Jerusalem to Babylon. And all the men of might, even 7,000, and craftsmen and smiths 1,000, and all that was strong and apt for war, even them the king of Babylon brought captive to Babylon. I've read those verses precisely to show something of the background here, how it was that these Jews found themselves initially in Babylon, here in Persia. Why were they there? They were there because of the exile. They were there because of the captivity. They were there basically because of the sins of Judah, especially idolatry. And Nebuchadnezzar had come down against the city of Jerusalem, especially in 586 BC, and had taken away thousands upon thousands of people. Now, E.J. Young makes the very interesting point that no nation had ever recovered from such a catastrophe. No nation under the sun. And he says that is why God gives this prediction concerning the 600 years that precede the coming of Christ. No nation had ever recovered from this. How then could the Jews recover from this? They recovered from this precisely because the hand of God was upon them. And God's promise concerning the Messiah could not be thwarted, nor could it be undone, even though men such as Haman sought to do it, and even though men such as Herod sought to do it. So we see here the wonderful providence of God, even in the midst of chastisement, even in the midst of punishment. It was no easy thing to bear being deported from your homeland. It was no easy thing to have to go into a strange, hostile country with a strange language and suffer the rude manners of those that were godless and live in that alien society and stand for God. But God's hand was upon his people. Let me remind you what I said last week. That is that Frederick the Great, I think he was the leader at the time of Luther, is that not right? Frederick the Great, Friedrich der Große. He was the leader of Saxony at the time of Luther. Frederick the Great once said that as far as he was concerned, one of the great arguments for the existence of God was the survival of the Jew. And that's what we have here in this passage, in this chapter, the survival of the Jew, the way in which in spite of God's chastisement of them, in spite of their deportations, in spite of their exile, in spite of the suffering, God brings them back. 50,000 in 538 BC, another 7,500 in 458 BC. So we see here the hand of God in a very remarkable way during these centuries that lead up to the coming of Christ. Now then, the point about this passage here is this, that this passage in 2 Kings chapter 24 that I just read places the date of the taking captive of Mordecai's ancestors. Obviously they preceded him. Mordecai's ancestors appear to have been taken away from Jerusalem roughly in 598 BC. The date, though, is now about 480. So it's something like 114 years that have lapsed. And so Mordecai's ancestors, his grandfather, perhaps his great-grandfather, had been taken away. And here he is. He finds himself living in this strange land. But he's known as Mordecai the Jew. It's difficult to know how much of their Judaism they retained, but it's important to notice that he is called Mordecai the Jew, and that this Judaism on his part arouses the enmity, the wicked enmity of this wicked man, Haman. So that's the situation. We have the situation whereby Esther is now there amongst the king's women, amongst the young virgins, and she, of course, is selected to become queen. Verse 8. So it came to pass, when the king's commandment and his decree was heard, and when many maidens were gathered together unto Shushan, the palace, to the custody of Haggai, that Esther was brought also unto the king's house, to the custody of Haggai, keeper of the women. And the maiden pleased him, and she obtained kindness of him. And he speedily gave her things for purification, with such things as belonged to her, and seven maidens, which were meet to be given her, out of the king's house. And he referred her and her maids unto the best place of the house of the women. Esther had not showed her people nor her kindred, for Mordecai had charged her that she should not show it. And Mordecai walked every day before the court of the women's house to know how Esther did and what should become of her. So Esther's not only brought into the vicinity of the king, Esther's finding favour with the king. She pleases him. He likes her. She was obviously a very beautiful young woman. But notice that we are told here, and it's emphasised twice in this chapter, that Esther had not showed her people nor her kindred. She hadn't revealed the fact that she was a Jew. Mordecai, her cousin, almost her uncle, her foster father in effect, had told her not to. She was to keep it quiet. Now that fact, of course, is revealed when the crisis develops. When Esther goes in unto the king and he holds out the gold scepter to her and allows her to come, and she reveals the wicked plot of Haman, it's at that point and not till then that Esther reveals this whole matter of her Jewish background. It's Mordecai the Jew. She is not referred to as Esther the Jewess, but she was a Jewess. That was her background, that was her ethnicity. And it stands her in good stead, and stands the Jews in good stead, as this terrible crisis unfolds involving Haman and his wicked plans. The whole issue of timing is very interesting in this book. Watch out for it. You'll come later on to two feasts, or two banquets, if you like, that Esther holds. And she invites the king to come to the first banquet, but doesn't say anything to him. And then mysteriously she asks, this is in the next few chapters, mysteriously she asks that they come back tomorrow for another banquet. And in the intervening night, the king could not sleep and discovers that it was Mordecai that in fact had unearthed this plot against the king. And Mordecai deserved rightly to be rewarded. So then, verse 12. Now when every maid's turn was come to go in to King Ahasuerus, after that she had been 12 months according to the manner of the women, for so were the days of their purifications accomplished, to wit 6 months with oil of myrrh, and 6 months with sweet odours, and with other things for the purifying of the women, then thus came every maiden unto the king, whatsoever she desired was given her, to go with her out of the house of the women unto the king's house. In the evening she went, and on the morrow she returned into the second house of the women, to the custody of Shashgaz, the king's chamberlain, which kept the concubines. She came in unto the king no more, except the king delighted in her, and that she were called by name. So then she's there amongst the king's concubines, and the king is getting to know her, and his choice soon falls upon her, as we read in the next few verses. Now, when the turn of Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her for his daughter, was come to go in unto the king, she required nothing but what Haggai, the king's chamberlain, the keeper of the women, appointed. And Esther obtained favour in the sight of all them that looked upon her. So Esther was taken unto King Ahasuerus into the house royal in the 10th month, which is the month Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. And the king loved Esther above all the women, and she obtained grace and favour in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. I cannot help feeling that his attitude, his approach, his treatment of Vashti was wicked. But this is part of the wicked acts of men. We see God's hand overruling it. We see Esther being brought in to replace her. And as a result, the connection between her and Mordecai is soon going to bring forth wonderful fruit. Notice that she obtained favour in the sight of the king. There's a number of instances in the scriptures. Joseph in the Old Testament is one. Daniel is another. Mordecai is another. Esther herself is another. Of people that find favour with the kings, with those that are in high places. And that this favour that they find, it's because of their character in large part. Because of this favour, they are able to influence these potentates, these kings. You see it in Joseph with Pharaoh. You see it in Daniel with Nebuchadnezzar. You see it with Esther here, and you see it also with Mordecai a little later. Men of God who are brought into positions of prominence and favour, and that is always a good thing when men of God can influence men of power in this particular way. And so we find this, that in verse 21, I beg your pardon, verse 18, then the king made a great feast unto all his princes and his servants, even Esther's feast. And he made a release to the provinces and gave gifts according to the state of the king. And when the virgins were gathered together the second time, then Mordecai sat in the king's gate. Esther had not yet shown her kindred nor her people, as Mordecai had charged her. For Esther did the commandment of Mordecai, like as when she was brought up with him. Notice the proximity between Esther and Mordecai. Notice how this foster parent cares deeply for this young woman. It's a sad fact that many parents, generally non-Christian parents of course, give the impression they could not care less about the way in which their children are brought up. They don't know where they are. They don't know what they're doing. They don't know what they get up to. It's not surprising they get up to all sorts of things. But of course, the Christian parent is different. Mordecai is a good example of that. He cares deeply for this young lady who is in fact his cousin, but more like his daughter, and is constantly watching over her and constantly seeking to influence her life and act as counsel to her. So then, once again, we are told Esther had not yet showed her kindred nor her people. Mordecai has told her not to reveal it. It's not to be revealed until the time comes. Now notice the last few verses, because these last few verses, verses 21 through to the end, are very significant. In those days, while Mordecai sat in the king's gate, two of the king's chamberlains, Bigthan and Teresh, of those which kept the door, were wroth and sought to lay hand on the king Ahasuerus. And the thing was known to Mordecai, who told it unto Esther the queen, and Esther certified the king thereof in Mordecai's name. And when inquisition was made of the matter, it was found out. Therefore they were both hanged on a tree, and it was written in the book of the Chronicles before the king. Now the significance of that is this, that here we have an obvious plot against the life of the king, a plot on the part of these two men, king's chamberlains, Bigthan and Teresh, a wicked, murderous plot. The plot is foiled basically because of Mordecai's intervention. Now, the interesting thing is this, and this is an important element in the story, Mordecai is not really known to be the one that has revealed the plot. It's Esther that makes it known to the king. And whether or not the king knew of Mordecai is not really clear, but it's not till later that Mordecai is rewarded for this fact. So bear that in mind as the story progresses, that this plot has been developed, the plot is foiled, Esther reveals it to the king, and both of these wicked men are hanged on a tree. But Mordecai is the one that is responsible for the unveiling of this plot, and before long he is rewarded in a very wonderful way, and that becomes an integral strand in the story. What we have here is the wonderful weaving together of different strands in the providence of God. There is no mention of God's name in this book. There's no mention of God's name in society in which we live, except often in blasphemy. But we should never forget that God still reigns over that society. It's a wicked and adulterous generation. It's a wicked society. And God's name is the last thing that is upon their lips, except in blasphemy. But that does not mean that God does not reign. He still reigns. He still rules. And we see the reign and the rule of God in this wonderful book. The hand of God, the finger of God, even though the name of God is absent, as it is in society, still the hand of God is upon us, just as it was upon them. And in due season, the plot is revealed. Esther goes in unto the king. She pleads with the king at the risk of her life. The king receives her. And as a result, that wicked man Haman is actually hanged upon the gallows that he had erected for Mordecai himself. A wonderful, wonderful irony that the very gallows which Haman had set up for Mordecai, Haman himself was hanged upon. So then, this is the book of Esther. I encourage you to continue reading it, to continue to profit from it. All scripture is given by inspiration of God and is profitable for us. And therefore we should read it and imbibe it and meditate upon these things. They are the things that sanctify and edify the Christian mind and heart. Amen.